Welcome back, Deep Divers. Today we're going to be cracking open a really cool part of the Bible, Joshua chapter 5.
It's a pivotal chapter for sure.
Yeah, it really sets the stage for the Israelite conquest of the Promised Land. Lots of action coming up.
But before the battles and the conquering, there's this really fascinating section about ritual preparations.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're going to dig into today.
The Israelites had to go through these specific rituals before they could even enter the land, right?
Right. It wasn't just about, you know, military strategy. They had to be spiritually prepared as well.
And you've got some great sources here, commentaries, historical analysis, even some archaeological stuff.
Yeah. It's amazing how much we can learn about this period, about the beliefs and practices of the Israelites.
You know, it's going to be interesting to see how these ancient rituals might still speak to us today.
Definitely. Okay. So where do we even begin? There are like three main rituals we got to unpack. Circumcision, Passover, and then this mysterious encounter with a commander.
Sounds like a plan. Why don't we start with circumcision? That's always a good conversation starter.
Well, maybe not at a dinner party. But for our purposes, yeah, let's dive in. So circumcision, this isn't your typical everyday ritual.
Yeah, the text specifically mentions a second circumcision.
A second one. What does that even mean?
Well, remember, the Israelites wandered in the desert for 40 years, right?
Right.
A whole generation grew up without this ritual.
Oh, I see.
So this second circumcision was really about bringing that generation into the covenant, making sure everyone was on the same page, spiritually speaking.
A sort of eat your commitment then.
Exactly. It was a powerful symbol of a fresh start.
And it all happened at a place called, hold on, Gibeah Herat.
The Hill of Foreskins?
Yeah, that's what it says.
Yeah.
Not the most delicate name, but I guess it gets the point across. But, okay, hold on a second. This whole circumcision thing, it reminds me of that story about Moses.
You're thinking of the incident where God nearly killed Moses.
Yeah, that's the one. What was that all about again?
Well, it seems Moses hadn't circumcised his own son, and God was not happy about it.
Really? I mean, Moses, the guy who talked to God face to face.
Yeah, even Moses wasn't exempt from this commandment.
So his wife, Zipporah, had to step in and perform the circumcision herself.
That's right. She basically saved Moses' life. Pretty intense stuff.
Wow, that's a pretty heavy story.
Yeah.
It makes you think about the pressures of leadership, even for someone like Moses, and the importance of upholding tradition.
Absolutely. And I think that's what's so striking about this second circumcision in Joshua. It's like a direct echo of that earlier story.
Like, hey, Israelites, remember what happened to Moses? Don't mess with his covenant stuff.
Exactly. And notice the detail about the flint knives. They used the same kind of knives that were used back in Moses' time.
Wow, I didn't catch that. Okay. So they're really emphasizing the continuity, connecting back to that original covenant.
Exactly. It's a powerful reminder of their heritage and their obligations to God.
And they're finally leaving behind that whole Egypt experience, all those years of slavery and wandering. No wonder they named the place Gilgal, which means to roll away.
Yeah, the reproach of Egypt has been rolled away. A new chapter is beginning.
So they're circumcised, cleansed, ready for what's next. Which brings us to Passover. Their first Passover in the Promised Land.
And they celebrate it on the 14th day of the month, just as commanded in Exodus. They're sticking to the rules.
Meticulous, aren't they? But here's what I love. The very next day, they finally get to taste the produce of the land. Unleavened cakes and parched grain. Can you imagine?
After 40 years of manna.
Yeah, manna every single day. It must have been incredible to finally sink their teeth into something.
Well.
Something new.
And it marks a crucial shift, you know?
How so?
The manna stops. No more free lunch from heaven. Now they have to work the land, plant crops, and reap what they sow.
It's like going from takeout to like a farm-to-table experience, right?
That's a great way to put it. They're moving from dependence on God's miraculous provision to relying on their own efforts.
So they're taking ownership of this new land.
Exactly. And it's interesting, Moses actually foreshadowed this in Deuteronomy. He talks about the Israelites inheriting cities and houses they didn't build, vineyards they didn't plant.
Whoa, that's a powerful image. It's like, I don't know, like inheriting a company you didn't start.
Yeah, or moving into a fully furnished house, they're stepping into something that's already established, something they didn't create themselves.
And that makes me think about the archaeological evidence. There isn't widespread destruction of Canaanite cities from this period, right?
Right, which suggests the Israelites didn't just wipe everyone out. They probably displaced some people, took over existing structures. It was more complicated than just conquest and destruction.
Okay, so that's circumcision and Passover, both really rich with symbolism and meaning. But now we got to talk about this mysterious encounter with the commander of the Lord's army. This is where things get a little supernatural, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. This scene sets the stage for the conquest of Jericho. You know, that whole marching around the city thing.
Right, right. Okay, so the scene is set. Joshua is outside Jericho, and suddenly this armed man appears.
And Joshua, being a practical guy, his first question is, are you for us or for our enemies?
Straight to the point. No time for small talk.
And the answer he gets, it's pretty cryptic. No.
No. What does that even mean?
It means the commander isn't taking sides in the way Joshua expects.
Oh, okay, I see. It's not about human alliances. It's about something bigger.
Right. Instead of answering the question directly, the man reveals his title, the commander of the Lord's army.
Whoa, so it's not just some random dude with a sword. This is a divine being.
And that's the whole point. Knowing WHO is in charge is more important than knowing which side he's on.
It's about trusting in God's command, not relying on human allies or military might.
Wow. Okay, but here's something I noticed. Joshua addresses the man as my lord. Isn't that a term usually used for humans?
Good observation. It seems Joshua doesn't yet realize who he's dealing with.
He's just focused on getting some answers. Exactly. But then comes the clincher. The commander tells Joshua to remove his sandals because the ground is holy.
Wait a minute. That's just like Moses at the burning bush.
Exactly. The narrative is drawing a parallel between these two encounters.
It's all about holiness, purification, and aligning oneself with God's will before engaging in battle.
These preparations were essential for the Israelites. They had to enter the promised land, not just as conquerors, but as a people set apart, dedicated to God's purpose.
Wow, that's powerful. But it makes you wonder, what does all this mean for us today? I mean, we're not conquering any lands or building altars.
That's a great question, and one we should definitely explore further. But first, there are a few other intriguing details in Joshua chapter 5 that I want to touch on, like that mention of the Israelites having uncircumcised hearts. What do you make of that?
Uncircumcised hearts, that sounds metaphorical.
It is, yeah. It's a metaphor for being closed off, hardened to God's will. Like, their hearts were unyielding.
Okay, I get it. So, it's not just about the physical act of circumcision. It's about an inner transformation.
Exactly. A willingness to open your heart to God.
To surrender to something bigger than yourself.
Yes. And that theme of transformation runs throughout Joshua.
Right. They're entering this new land, but it's also a new phase in their relationship with God.
A new level of commitment.
And that requires a change in mindset. Right. Letting go of the old ways, embracing the new.
Which brings us back to that idea of holy ground. Remember, Joshua was told to remove his sandals because he was standing on holy ground?
Yeah, just like Moses at the burning bush.
Yeah.
But what does that mean for us today? I mean, I'm not going to take off my shoes every time I walk into a church.
No, of course not. But it's a powerful symbol.
Of what?
Well, think about it. Holy ground is a place where you encounter the sacred, where you become aware of something larger than yourself.
Okay, yeah, I see that. Like a place where you feel a sense of awe.
Exactly. It could be a place of worship, a beautiful spot in nature, even an internal state of reverence.
So it's about cultivating those moments of awareness, those times when we recognize the sacred in the ordinary.
All right. Yes. And that awareness, that sense of connection, can be a powerful source of strength and guidance.
Okay, so we've got ritual purification, transformation of the heart, encounters with the divine, and the recognition of holy ground.
Yeah.
That's a lot to unpack. How do we even begin to apply these ancient concepts to our modern lives?
Well, I think it starts with recognizing that these stories, these rituals, aren't just about historical events.
What do you mean?
They're about universal human experiences, the need for preparation, the desire for connection, the struggle to overcome obstacles. These are things we all grapple with, regardless of our background or beliefs.
So it's about looking for the deeper truths that resonate across time and cultures, mm-hmm. not getting bogged down in the literal details.
Right. And that's where the real deep dive begins. It's not just about analyzing the text or the historical context.
It's about asking.
What does this story, this ritual, this encounter reveal about myself, about my own journey, about the challenges I face and the potential for transformation within me?
Whoa. Okay, we're getting deep here. It's like we're turning these ancient texts into mirrors, reflecting back our own hopes, fears, and aspirations.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And that's the power of these stories. They can speak to us across the centuries, offering guidance, wisdom, and inspiration.
But how do we make these ancient truths practical? I can't exactly build an altar in my living room or wander in the desert for 40 years.
Uh-huh. No. But you can create your own rituals, your own practices that help you connect with your inner self, with your values.
Like what?
Meditation, journaling, spending time in nature, engaging in creative pursuits.
So it's about finding those activities, those moments that help us tap into that sense of the sacred,
yeah.
that remind us of what truly matters.
Exactly. And recognizing that preparation isn't just about a to-do list. It's about cultivating a state of being, a mindset that allows us to face challenges with courage and clarity.
It's not about what we do, but about who we become in the process.
Precisely. Right. And that's a journey that requires constant attention, reflection, and a willingness to embrace the transformative power of life's experiences.
Okay, that's powerful. But before we wrap up, there's one more detail I want to go back to. In Joshua chapter 5, it mentions the Amorite kings being troubled when they hear about the Israelites crossing the Jordan River. It's almost like a glimpse into the minds of the enemy. What do you make of that?
I think it highlights the psychological impact of the Israelites' arrival. They had a reputation.
A reputation for what?
For their God, for their victories, for their unwavering faith.
So they weren't just a military threat. It was like a spiritual challenge to the existing order.
Exactly. And the fact that the Amorite kings were troubled suggests they sensed this. They weren't just facing an army. They were facing a people driven by a powerful belief system.
That's fascinating. It adds another layer to the story, reminding us that battles aren't just fought on physical battlefields.
Right. There's a spiritual and psychological dimension as well.
But how does that relate to our modern day battles? I mean, we're not fighting armies.
Well, it reminds us that our challenges, our own enemies, often reside within us.
What do you mean?
They might be internal struggles, limiting beliefs, fears that hold us back. And overcoming those obstacles takes more than just willpower or strategy.
You need something more.
You need a shift in mindset, a belief in something greater than yourself, and the courage to face those fears.
So it's not just about fighting against external obstacles.
Mm.
It's about conquering the limitations within ourselves.
Exactly. And that's where the real battle lies, within our own hearts and minds. And just like the Israelites needed faith and courage to conquer the promised land, we need those same qualities to conquer our own inner Canaan, to overcome our fears and step into our full potential.
I love that, conquering our inner Canaan. But where do we find that courage, especially when those fears feel so overwhelming?
I think it starts with remembering that we're not alone in this struggle. Just like the Israelites had their God, we have our own sources of strength and inspiration.
Our own support system.
Exactly. It could be our faith, our values, our loved ones, even our own inner wisdom. Tapping into those resources can give us the courage to face our fears.
So we don't have to go it alone.
Right. And remember, courage isn't the absence of fear. It's the willingness to act despite our fears.
It's about taking that first step, even if we're trembling.
Exactly. And that's where ritual and practice come in, creating those moments of connection, those practices that remind us of our values and purpose. They can provide the grounding and the courage we need to face our challenges.
Okay, so we've got ancient rituals, modern day battles, inner Canaans to conquer, and the courage to face our fears. That's a lot to unpack.
It is, but it's all connected. And ultimately, it's about remembering that we're not just observers of these stories. We're participants in our own unfolding narratives. And just like the Israelites had the potential for greatness within them, so do we.
It's not just about reading about ancient conquests. It's about embarking on our own personal journeys of transformation and growth.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And that journey, just like the Israelites' journey, is filled with challenges and opportunities. But with courage, faith, and a willingness to embrace the transformative power of life, we can all conquer our inner Canaans and step into our full potential.
That's a powerful message to end on. But before we wrap up completely, I want to pose one final question to our listeners. So we've talked about all this preparation and symbolism and these encounters with the divine, but there's one thing that keeps nagging at me. What about the people who are already living in Canaan? The Amorites, the Hittites, all those folks. What happened to them?
Ah, that's a question that often sparks a lot of debate, you know?
Yeah, I bet. I mean, the book of Joshua, it talks about the Israelites conquering cities, driving out inhabitants. It doesn't sound very peaceful.
It does raise some challenging questions, that's for sure. Especially when you read it from a modern perspective.
Right. Battles, destruction, taking land. How do we make sense of that? What's the takeaway for us today?
Well, it's important to keep in mind that the book of Joshua, it's primarily a theological narrative.
No.
You know?
What do you mean by that?
It's telling the story of God's faithfulness to his people, how he established Israel in the promised land, and the challenges they faced along the way. But it's not a historical account in the way we think of history today. And it's definitely not meant to be a blueprint for how we should act in the 21st century.
So we need to read it with a discerning eye, understanding its purpose, its genre.
Exactly. But we also need to acknowledge the complexity of the situation, right?
In what way?
The Israelites, they believe they were acting on God's command, fulfilling a promise made to their ancestors. But their actions, well, they raise some tough questions about the use of force, about displacement of people.
Yeah, it's definitely a nuanced situation, and there aren't any easy answers. Mm-hmm. It makes you think about the stories we tell ourselves, how we justify our own actions, and how those actions impact others.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's important to hold that tension, to grapple with the complexities of the text without shying away from those difficult questions. It challenges us to think critically about the stories we inherit, the narratives that shape our understanding of the world.
So what does all this mean for us today? How do we reconcile these ancient stories with our own values?
Well, I think it starts by recognizing that these stories, they're part of our shared human history. They contain both beauty and darkness, you know. They speak to our capacity for both compassion and cruelty.
So it's about acknowledging the full spectrum of human experience.
Yes. Our own history, our own societies, they're marked by both progress and setbacks, by justice and injustice. We can learn from the past, both its triumphs and its failures, as we try to create a more just and compassionate world.
It's a reminder that we're always in the process of becoming. Of striving toward a better version of ourselves, both individually and collectively.
Beautifully said. We're not just passive readers of these stories. We're active participants in shaping our own narratives, our own journeys toward a promised land, so to speak.
Absolutely. And that brings us back to the question I posed earlier. If you were standing on the banks of the Jordan River, about to cross over into a new phase of life, what would you do to prepare? What rituals or practices would help you face the challenges ahead?
That is such a powerful question, and it's one that each of us has to answer for ourselves, really. But I think the journey itself, the process of searching for those answers, that's where the real transformation happens.
That's a beautiful thought to end on. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Joshua chapter 5. It's been quite a journey.
My pleasure. Always a fascinating conversation.
And for our listeners, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep seeking those moments of connection that remind you of what truly matters. Until next time, deep divers.